So hello everyone, and so I'd like to have a little wave or something that you can hear me. Is that the case? Wonderful. Well, how nice to get waved at. I wish I could hear you say something too, but it feels so silent, the screen. So one announcement before I start, and that is that this evening I'll host a drop-in practice discussion group, and for the full participants of the retreat, you're welcome to come, and especially those of you who might be new to a retreat, I encourage you to come. But anybody can come if they want, and some people come just to listen. So if you're wondering if that's that, you don't have to come with a question or concern, and but you're welcome to come if you. If you feel it's supportive for you, at 7 o'clock. And then the auditors are going to have their own practice discussion, I think, tomorrow. So you'll get a chance as well. So to begin this talk, many of you are familiar with the story of Prince Siddhartha, the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, just his given name, the story of him living sequestered, sheltered in the palace until through his childhood and into young adulthood, all the way up to age of 29, because his father had the impression that if his son saw the suffering of the world, he would not want to be king. He would go off and become a religious seeker. And so the father successfully kept his son behind the palace walls until he was 29. Imagine what it would be like to be kind of sheltered that way. And it probably would have been created some strange mindsets in a young man's life. And then the Buddha-to-be, some point, managed to get over the walls and out into the town. And there he saw what's called sometimes the three heavenly messengers, sickness, old age, and death. And that inspired him. That moved him in a deep way, deeply moved, maybe even shaken by this. And then he saw the fourth heavenly messenger, which was a monastic, a renunciant, who was walking through the town peacefully, calmly, in a way that got his attention. He'd never seen this before, a person who was so present and so at home in themselves, so peaceful and just there in a full way. And so that inspired him to head out from the palace, basically sneak out and become the very thing his father didn't want him to be. And I think that maybe this is a story of more people than we care for, that a sheltered life, protected life, parents want you to be one thing and the children end up doing something else. And some people are shocked that the Buddha left his young child and his wife behind. So, you know, it's maybe many reasons or many ways to interpret that. But one of them is that this poor guy had been cooped up, cut off from society, the world, until he was 29. I mean, I can imagine the pressure to be released, the drive, the need to get out into the world was probably pretty deep. So he started his quest after having seen the three heavenly messengers, sickness, old age, and death. He became enlightened and spent some 40, 45 years teaching. And then we have a sutta, the discourse, of the Buddha's last days. And what's remarkable about this is the Buddha, many things remarkable about this text. What's remarkable is the Buddha at this point becomes the heavenly messengers. The story of the Buddha being sick, being old, and dying. If you are fortunate enough, maybe you'll be some of the heavenly messengers. If you're fortunate enough, maybe you will be at some point old and sick and dying and dead. Rumors are that at least one of those will happen to you. So this life of ours, we share this in common. We share sickness, old age, and death. We share the existential challenges of this life, the sickness, old age, and death of family, of friends, community. This is all part of what we're living in this world. It can't be any other way. But how do we live with this inevitable confrontation, meeting with these big issues and the sorrow, the loss that, of course, it entails? So the Buddha spent 40, 45 years teaching that. And one of the things that he taught, the way he taught, the motivation for him to teach, over and over again, the way it's described in the text, is that he was motivated by anukampa, one of the heart qualities that we're bringing up for this retreat. And anukampa is described as the wish or the wanting of the welfare and happiness of others. Welfare and happiness, wanting others to be well, wanting others to be happy, for them to be successful, for their welfare. It's a little different than wanting their suffering to end, which is a very powerful, beautiful thing to have that kind of compassion for people suffering. This anukampa is broader and is seen as the foundation for other caregiving emotions and motivations. It's considered kind of, it's the one that the Buddha operated on over and over again, as the texts say. And it's the one that he encouraged his followers to live by. People who became enlightened, he sent forth to become teachers. He said, go forth for the welfare and happiness of the many out of anukampa. And my favorite translation of this word anukampa is care. And I love this English word care because it has two meanings in English. It can mean you value something. You care about something and you value it. But also can mean that you tend to it. You take care of it. You actively help it or support it or something. And these two things, I think, go really beautifully together. To think something is valuable and to want to help, and not just help. Help sometimes is a little bit, sets up the notion that people need to be helped, and maybe sometimes a funny dynamic between people, but to have the wish to support people's welfare and happiness, their well-being. And that's what drove the Buddha. And I think the Buddha didn't first and foremost see human beings as suffering. He saw them as dignified, as respect-worthy. In fact, there's very little said in the ancient texts about how this anukampa, this primary caregiving emotion, what stimulates it, what triggers it, evokes it. But one of the few things it says, it seems to come out of, and all four of these words are used in the text: respect, honoring, respecting others, honoring others, venerating others, and having reverence for others. Wow! When's the last time you had all four for someone that you ran into? And that somehow the motivation maybe for the Buddha to teach was out of this deep respect, maybe even reverence for life and for human beings. You see a little bit of that in the Buddha's metaphors he uses, similes he uses to describe people who are going to practice, anybody at all, not just the monastics. Sometimes in analogies he's using, the analogy for a practitioner is a king or a queen. And that's a, you know, that's quite something. So this idea that there's no self in Buddhism and therefore you shouldn't count and you should just kind of like be self-effacing. But here he's saying, you know, he's saying to be a practitioner, he sees practitioners as being like kings and queens. Wow, isn't that kind of a little haughty? Or, you know, am I allowed to feel that way? Isn't that conceited? Another metaphor he used for practitioners is he saw them as thoroughbreds. As actually, it's the adjective in front of it, wonderful or wondrous thoroughbreds. And a thoroughbred, in my mind, is a horse that's really strong and vital and capable. It's kind of like a, I don't know, like monarchs of horses, kind of. And so here, the Buddha is referring to people with so much respect, so much, and out of that respect, he cares. And he lived a life of care. I love the word care because it's a humble word. It's a simple concept because it's possible to care for people that you don't like. As soon as you have to have love for people, sometimes even compassion or loving kindness, which are such beautiful treasures to have those sentiments, but it's a little bit of a high bar to get. And to have it for all people, and some people are do things which are kind of like not really right. And then, you know, so what are we supposed to love them? But we can have a certain kind of respect for them. We can care for them. As I said yesterday in my talk, maybe some of you heard that, I asked a friend of mine who has stage 4 cancer and going in and out of the hospital. I said, what would you prefer, that the medical staff who are nursing you, taking care of you, would you rather they had compassion for you or that they had care for you? And he immediately said, oh, I prefer care than compassion. And in fact, these nurses who are taking care of me, they are phenomenally inspiring, how caring they are. But I don't get the sense that they love us, love me, or have compassion for me. But they are so good and careful and attentive, and they really, really care about what they do and care about the people. And so that's an interesting contrast, you know, that we can offer care to people, ordinary care, simple care. If there was a neighbor down the street who did distasteful things and everything that you kind of is a challenging for you, that person's doing. And but then you find the person injured on the sidewalk one day with a broken leg. And all the things the person has done fades away. And you go see what you can do to bring support, help for the person. The instinct to care is so basic. In one place, the Buddha likens the instinct to care, this anukampa, with the attitude a mother has for a baby while she's nursing it. It's a kind of sweet time. I think that there's a lot of oxytocin involved at that time when mothers are nursing. And that's what my wife seemed to say to me, that she would have these good feelings, wonderful feelings of care that would come up. So this caring instinct. And so we practice with care. It's possible to practice with respect for oneself, with even a reverence for oneself, and to practice caring for oneself. And sometimes I know it's hard to have love for oneself, even compassion for oneself. But if we want to borrow how the Buddha treated us, treated the people that he was with, we treat ourselves with care. We would treat ourselves with dignity, with value. We're important. And I think this message that we're important, that we're worthy, that we're valuable human beings, is such an important one for many people in our culture here. Maybe not for all of you, but there are people who haven't gotten that message. And someone was telling me a couple of years ago of taking some, excuse me for a moment. Taking some inner city kids camping, and one of them had its birthday that day and while camping, so they made a birthday party. And then the person said that in his life, he'd never had a birthday party. It was the first time. So the kind of underlying this Buddhism is this idea of respect, of reverence, of care, valuing this human life that we live. And it's simply the fact that we live and share this life, hopefully is enough that we want to care for each other and care for ourselves. And so we come to this retreat, and I like to believe that all of us are here to care for ourselves, to promote our welfare and happiness. The advantage of wanting welfare and happiness means that sometimes you're not going to be suffering. And sometimes in meditation, suffering falls away and you feel joy and happiness and peace. And even in those states, it's possible to promote even greater well-being, greater happiness. In fact, we encourage in Buddhism not to settle, not to shortchange ourselves. Not to only provide ourselves with some kind of meditative joy and happiness, but to go all the way to the greatest happiness, which is defined or described as a certain kind of liberation and freedom. So that's the kind of the context of this practice, the context of the human challenges, plenty of human challenges we all face. No one's immune to it. Sickness, old age, and death, and so much more. And Buddhism has been designed to meet that. Buddhism wasn't designed for stress reduction. So you can go back to work and, I don't know, I mean, that's a good thing to have stress reduction. It's good to go back to work, maybe. But it's not some simple way of just kind of continuing a life that maybe is not so great for the planet, and just feeling peaceful about it because you've learned how to have a personal peace. The practice was designed for us to really come to terms with the fundamental existential issues of our life, calling upon one of the fundamental instincts of care. Parental kind of cares is the best forms of that is kind of what the reference point for this practice is. So how do we do that? Or what are we called to do for this process? And as I said yesterday, we're called upon or instructed to cultivate, to develop ourselves. And if you want to hike up a very steep, big, tall mountain, you have to have some kind of physical strength to do it. And some people will train, develop themselves, cultivate themselves so they can climb that mountain and get the view that that provides. It's similar to doing this Buddhist practice. We have to develop ourselves, become stronger in a variety of ways so we can climb the mountain and get the insight, the view that that the Dharma can provide us. It's not a, for some people, it's not a very appealing message that Dharma is about developing ourselves and cultivating some capacity, partly because some of us are exhausted already by all the messages of doing, 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 and become better and self-improvement and all that. And here we get that Buddhism says the same thing. People get discouraged, overwhelmed. And some people actually prefer Buddhist teachings that don't do anything. Stop the doing. Just be. just accept. There's nothing to do, nothing to be, nothing to get. And as an antidote to overdoing and overstriving, those teachings are fantastic. But it also might leave us, if you use the analogy of going up the mountain, you said, don't do anything, just be. There's nothing to get, nothing to do. But then it turns out that the medicine your neighbor needs is up on top of the mountain. And you don't have the strength to go up there and get it because you've never developed yourself. Then you were kind of, you know, for a week, we're much more likely to be pushed around by the winds of the world, by the challenges of the world. We're not prepared for all the mountains that come our way, the mountains of sickness, old age, and death. So some development, some cultivating ourselves is part of the practice. And it's meant to be a patient process. It's not really, it's better not to look at it. This is like, you know, instant enlightenment. Like I'm just going to, this is the retreat, my first retreat, and I'm going to really push hard and get enlightened. And then I can go on and live the rest of my life. There's lots to do in this life. But rather it's a respectful, steady, mature way of just engaging in the process of learning a skill, learning something, developing something, like you learn a language or learn how to do art or play music or a profession. It takes a while to develop the skills and the capacity for it. When I was in the Zen monastery, after I was there for about 9 months, I was assigned to the kitchen. And that was an adventure for us, the kitchen for a year. And I remember that the first day I went into the kitchen, I was overwhelmed by how big the kitchen was. And I was so small and, you know, and I had never really cooked before, especially at that level, cooking for, you know, many, many people. And so I remember being kind of intimidated by it. I did it for a year. And just almost to the day, a year later, I was having my last day in the kitchen and I was alone in the kitchen. And I looked around and the kitchen now felt really small and I felt big. I had to some degree had mastered that kitchen. And then slowly over 365 days, slowly and steadily, kind of imperceptibly, I had developed skills, the ability, confidence. And now I had the ability to be there. And I felt big. I felt kind of capable. I felt confident. And I was not intimidated anymore. So life is much, you know, more than a kitchen. But life can be the same way, that we can feel overwhelmed by it. Life is so big, so difficult, so challenging. And I'm so small and, you know, intimidated. But as we develop our inner life, that can shift. And the world can seem manageable. The world, and we can feel like, oh, I'm confident that there's a strength here. I'm here in a full way. And then again, maybe I shouldn't talk this way too much, but I think some of the ways in which Buddhism is taught here in the West, it kind of undermines this development and strength building that's part of the practice. And it doesn't give it enough due that that somehow we're supposed to just be able to accept things as they are, and then everything will be fine. But it's a lot easier to accept things if you feel mastery over them or confident in yourself, feel like you can stand on your own two feet and look reality right in the eye and say, I see you and I'm here and you're there. And there's a sense of presence and sense of understanding and self-confidence that comes with developing. So meditation practice is a practice of cultivating and developing ourselves slowly over time. And probably for most of us, it's imperceptible how the skills we're developing, the capacities we're developing. And one of those is stability. The ability to be grounded and settled, to be able to be a certain kind of stillness within, that we can kind of like stand on our own two feet and be still, unagitated, looking at life directly, no matter how difficult it is, being present in the middle of it. Rather than having the message that there's not self and you don't count, and kind of forget about yourself, don't think about yourself. There's truth to that to some degree, but we do that if we're going to kind of forget about the self in a certain healthy way. It's after we're become upright, stable, steady, strong people. Some people feel very reluctant to stand up and count, like I have a right to be here. It's okay for me to be fully myself. It's a hard lesson for many people to learn. But the respect that Buddha has for us, the reverence that we have, we can do this. It's okay to do this, provided we do it in a way that doesn't harm anyone. And that's part of the skill we're learning. And what supports stability is learning to live ethically. If we live in ways that are harmful, and for many people who come to these retreats, I think they're basically, you're all good people, but sometimes there's little places that can be improved. And one of the most common ones is speech. But to have speech which doesn't distress you, after the fact you don't feel embarrassed or regretful, or you have to deal with the consequences for, you know, because someone was upset by what you told them. But to be able to live without causing harm makes it much easier to stand tall, metaphorically stand tall, and just be there fully and not kind of diminish yourself. Both stand tall without diminishing and without being puffed up. Just being, but a being that is kind of strong and steady. So to cultivate stability, to cultivate a steadiness in practice, to cultivate a capacity to hold still or be grounded. And what Nikki talked about this morning about embodiment is a huge part of this process of learning to be able to really inhabit your life in a strong, full way. Cultivating your attention to the body, your embodiment, your body fullness, the way to be aware through the body, you can leapfrog in the development of this stability. And part of the reason for that is that what makes many people unstable, unsteady, where we're buffeted around by the events of the world, is that, like Nikki said, you know, we're living in our thoughts, we're top heavy, and so we're pushed over easily, and we can't come back up. And so the swirling thoughts and ideas and attachments and projections into the future, fears of what's going to happen, interpretations of what did happen, stories that happened in the past that we live in and swirl in, all these things make us unstable. So one of the ways to develop this stability, a strength in stability, is not directly like building a muscle, but some of it has to do with relaxing. Relaxing the thinking muscle, relaxing the ways that we get swept away in thoughts. All of you have spent a lot of time thinking. Probably the track record of making your life better by thinking, for most of you, is probably pretty poor. For some of you, it's about time to start to try a different strategy. There is a healthy getting tired of the old strategy. It hasn't worked. Well, maybe tomorrow it'll work. There's always this promise. It's just right around the corner. I'll figure it out. But to begin feeling, having come into the decision or the idea that, I don't need to be so committed to my thinking. Thinking is fine. I don't want to disrespect myself. And sometimes thinking is crucial. But maybe in meditation, I can learn a different way. And the different way is to begin cultivating embodied stability, to really show up for oneself. You count. You're important. To have a deep respect for yourself, that you are important. You count. It's okay for you to show up in this life. But not show up with your desires, not shows up with your ambitions, not to show up with your fears necessarily, but to show up in the present moment as if being in the present moment, you're really fully, completely here. Because you count, you're important. To be anything less than fully inhabiting this moment probably means that you've succumbed to the world of thinking and fantasy and past and stories. Fantasies about the future. And I don't want to dismiss the importance of some of the things you're thinking about. But maybe you'll show up for the things you're thinking about, what you have to take care of in your world, so much better. You can care for it better when you've become, you really know how to be here. So when you're sitting, you're really sitting. You're rooted on your chair, on your cushion. You're here. When you're standing, you're really here. You know where you're standing. And you know you're standing here in your body. If you're walking, you really know that you're walking. And you're inhabiting the walking. And so it's a cultivation practice where slowly, slowly, you come back to over and over again to being embodied, being here. Over and over again, you let go of the thoughts that make you unstable and scattered so that you begin gathering and collecting yourself here. And a lot of the meditation practice is, in fact, about this gathering, collecting, embodying, and being here that's enabled when strategically, for the purposes of doing this, you're willing to put aside some of the usual activities that your mind is involved in. We do this for other things, other trainings we develop. If you're going to learn to, play a musical instrument, while you're training on the instrument, you're probably not thinking actively about your taxes and calculating, how much you should pay. You're not telling yourself the story about tomorrow or yesterday so much that your mind kind of puts that aside to some degree so you can really be there in the training. This is much harder to do in meditation because it's not as interesting as playing an instrument initially. And so you're really left with yourself. But the advantage of being left with yourself is you're really honestly dealing with the raw material of who you are. We can get you concentrated much faster. There are concentration techniques. You can actually probably get concentrated faster than you are on the retreat already if you pick up juggling balls. But in juggling balls or other techniques you have for getting focused, you're bypassing the raw material of actually how it goes on when you're left to your own devices. So meeting yourself with all the challenges of your mind, your boredom, your desires, your fears, is part of important part of the practice in developing stability, steadiness, being here. One of the ways we develop stability and steadiness in this practice is a continuity of practice, is a gentle, loving, respectful, caring commitment to just keep doing it, step after step after step, breath after breath after breath, moment after moment. Whenever you remember, show up respectfully, caringly for this moment. And I say that, I want to underscore, if I could like bold my speech, I would have said, in bold, caringly, respectfully. Because the strategy of being angry at yourself for the mind going off doesn't really work for meditation. It doesn't help you develop the stability and the steadiness. It just agitates it again more. The art of it is to learn when the mind wanders off, when things are challenging for you in meditation, to show back up again in the present moment in a way that feels harmonious with this respect and care that we want to bring to the practice. Respect and love sometimes. And what does that look like? The mind wanders off for the 10th time, 100th time, 1,000 times. And rather being upset, rather than being frustrated, angry, or discouraged, what would it look like for you to begin again with the steps as you walk, to begin again with the breathing as you're sitting here, to begin again with just reclaiming your embodiment, to do it in a way that feels in harmony with respect, with care, with love, with being peaceful? I can't answer that question for you. It's something you have to experiment with and find and be creative and find what does Gil mean and how do I do this? And, I never wander off in my thoughts, so I don't understand what he's talking about. Well, that's good for you. Then you don't have to worry about it. But if you're one of those people who wander off in your thoughts and ideas, there are a few people like that, then you're the laboratory. You're the where the field work is done to discover how to do this practice. And how could you come back harmoniously as if you have to do it 10,000 times? They say you become a master after 10,000 times. So you might have to do this coming back and starting over again many times, over and over again. And slowly you're developing stability, strength, patience, steadiness, holding the course, being able to first doing walking meditation and hold the course with two steps, then staying present and embodied for four steps. And then maybe you get up to five. And then there's a leap to nine. And slowly, the continuity, staying in the flow, staying with it. And same thing with seated meditation. The commitment to really lovingly, permissively allowing yourself to just keep showing up, staying there, staying there, staying with it, but without being ambitious. Without needing to be successful. Those are all agitating and for most people. Just stay there, come back, train yourself, work on it, come back. The first day of a retreat is often a difficult day for people. A lot of tiredness, sometimes unexpected pains, back pains, knee pains. Headaches. The mind is more restless than it's ever been, sometimes first day of a retreat. First day of the retreat, we kind of stop from all the busyness of life and unresolved issues pop up, emotions pop up that we were surprised to have to meet with. All kinds of things can happen. I learned the hard way through a lot of suffering that all I was asked to do in practice was to show up with and practice with the best effort that was available. And when I'm tired, the effort isn't that good. But it's still, I offer the best that's available. And rather than being upset with myself that it doesn't look as good as when I was bright and awake, I kind of pat my back and say, Gil, given the circumstances, you did the best you could. And the continuity, what builds with this practice is not the continuity of stellar effort. It's the continuity of the best effort that's available. That's all you're asked to do. But to do it, and to the degree to which you're able to do it all day long. When you have a break in the retreat, like at the mealtime or something like that, how could you continue, have a continuity of mindfulness, continuity of embodiment through that lunchtime, eating and taking care of things and taking a break, that's in harmony both with the activity and what your need is during the break? We need breaks. We need to get some rest. So you don't want to strain and try to always, you know, this high level effort. But how do you keep some modicum of presence in the breaks so that you don't drift off too easily? So slowly, over time, by living a simple life on retreat, not having a lot of social interactions, maybe very few, hopefully, not being on devices, that there's a kind of the body, the whole, our psychophysical system begins to unwind, begins to settle. And that unwinding and settling, that's kind of a natural process. We want to care for that and support it, protect it. Because this building, its cultivation of stability is not just something that we do, but something we allow for. We protect our environment, protect ourselves. We allow the possibilities of relaxation. We allow the possibility of settling. Rather than, you know, going, you know, it was a nice day on retreat, and I think there's probably a nice, you know, it was Halloween, I missed it yesterday evening, and I might as well go to Netflix and watch a horror movie. You know, that's not going to protect this process of settling and relaxing and being here. You are all respect-worthy people. Sometimes I feel that the people I encounter on retreat, like all of you, I feel a reverence for everyone. And sometimes an awe, deep appreciation that you've decided to come here, that you're engaged in this way. It's called a noble endeavor that you're on. You're like monarchs and thoroughbreds, worthy of care, worthy of your own care for yourself. And just knowing that, maybe you can allow something in you to relax, something in you which has not been seen or recognized before, where you don't have to prove yourself anymore. You don't have to apologize for yourself anymore. In the simplicity of this practice, you're allowed to be who you are embodied, full, present, really here. You're allowed that to show up. And the more you do it, the more you cultivate that ability. The more you do it, the stronger you'll become in a steadiness, a groundedness, an embodiment, a stability. And it'll start feeling like a resource. It starts feeling like you carry something valuable with you, a strength, a capacity with you that will support you wherever you go. You won't be buffeted so much by what happens around you because of that stability, that groundedness that is cultivated. And then you'll be ready when the time comes for insights. And those insights will land in a fertile field, developing stability, steadiness, continuity, stillness, an inner stillness. It's kind of like preparing the ground for something that's going to be planted and grow. And the insights are the seeds that are planted that then will take root in the soil that you've made. So take good care of yourself. And maybe the expression taking care of yourself now has a richer meaning, since it was such an important word for the Buddha, care. Take good care of yourself with respect for yourself. And please, you know, give yourself over to the retreat as much as you can. And if you can't do it in the usual retreat mode, then give the retreat over to what else you have to do. Bring it along. This is a opportunity of a lifetime to be on retreat. It's meant to help us for a lifetime. And if you're lucky enough to become the messenger for sickness, old age, and death, maybe you'll be an inspiring messenger because you've learned how to go through it peacefully, stably, and wisely, so others are inspired to do the same. May you enjoy this practice. So thank you very much. And some of you I'll see it at 7, and some of you will see you soon enough other ways. Thank you very, very much.